Hello, and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures Podcast, presented by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with Shoshimworks, a global firm helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping society, industry, economy, and policy, and reframing how we build for resilient futures. Today, we're continuing our investigation into the ways that AI is informing ecosystems across industry and society and exploring how we design pathways to resilient futures. I'm Diane Finkhausen, founder and CEO of Shoshimworks. And today I'm joined by my co-host, Mark Steven Meadows, science fiction writer and researcher for NASA's CAS project. Mark.
Hi, it's great to do this again. Ben, thank you very much for joining us. Today, we're welcoming Ben Cerveny, president of the Foundation for Public Code. Ben and I met maybe in the 90s during the heyday of San Francisco's invention of things like back buttons, very early websites. And then we met again when we were both working on a research in Amsterdam. Ben, I will let you introduce yourself. I've always been amazed at your work and your ability to lean forward and get a far view like a meteorologist, the far-flung cliffs of technology, the high views. And please, Ben, if you would, take it away. Tell us about yourself.
Sure thing. Thanks, Mark. And thanks, everyone, for inviting me here. It's a pleasure to be here. Yeah, I have been along for the ride. As Mark said, I think we sort of came up during a period in which a lot of technological advancement and change were happening in the world. And we sort of, I think, helped make that happen. I've worked in a variety of roles over the years. I was the chief information architect back when that was a thing at one of the biggest web agencies called Organic back in the 90s, but also ran an industrial design experience design group at Frog Design. Have been on the founding team at Flickr and a design fellow with Samsung for many years, working on research projects with them, now I'm running a foundation based in Amsterdam called the Foundation for Public Code.
Ben, would you talk a little bit more about that, please? Public code is obviously a couple of very important words to all of us here. Could you spell this out?
Yeah, in fact, the whole title of the organization is sort of overloaded in the sense that the Foundation is both a nonprofit organization, but also the basis on which a lot of this stuff can be enacted. Public code is interesting because those words mean a lot of different things. In our case, they mean two very important things. One is that public is both meaning open in the sense of open source, but also public in terms of the public sector and the sort of activities provided by public administrations like cities and states to their citizens and constituents. And code is both software, instructions written for the computer, and also policy that are rule spaces in which societies operate. And so that's sort of the convergence that we're talking about with this foundation and how to bring together the worlds of technology and policy into a single sort of open stack that serves the citizens of the public administrations in which it runs.
I'm curious to hear you, if you would, please talk a little bit more about code and how society works in code. I don't want to set us off on a tangent too much, but that's a pretty important observation, I think.
Oh, it's really, I think it's super important to think about. And one of the things that I really am interested in people understanding is that in some ways, the policy itself is a technology as well. I mean, civilization began with sort of the running of that code, the idea that we came together as a set of people to build abstractions that are organizations, the scale of cities and states. And those things, in order to operate, require a rule space that people agree to operate inside of. And that's what policy is. And so the interesting part about that is it shares a lot of characteristics with software code and the way that has sort of come to underlie so many of our activities in the digital age. And we don't really think about that very much. We don't think about policy or software very much in terms of how it really makes almost all the activities that we pursue on a daily basis possible. So both, that's one of the things that's this sort of magic of something like the city is that it sort of disappears around you. You don't realize how much you're taking advantage of the system that it's providing you. And we're kind of getting to that moment with software as well.
Yeah, you remind me of Hammurabi's code and some of the very early precepts that were set down thousands of years ago. It's always interesting, Ben, to hear you talk about things like language as technology. as well, policy as technology. One last thing here, and then I want to try to get us a little bit back on track here. You mentioned a rule space. That rule space in which technology or language policy works within, can you tell us a little bit about who owns that and how that ownership process develops?
Yeah, that's probably the most sort of pressing issue about this whole, part of the reason why we formed the foundation is that there is this need for democratic societies to have this policy, this code base, be something that is accountable, transparent, deliberative, contestable. These things are all super sort of fundamental to the idea of a democratic society. And unfortunately, the way that most code bases are maintained at this point is as private black boxes that are operated by their owners. And so as we go through the process of looking at how do we make digital the society, we have to be very mindful of the fact that in the transference of these rule spaces that we call policy into the rule spaces that we call software, we need to make sure that we preserve all these characteristics of transparency and accountability and contestability.
This is something that I think is given. It should be transparent. It should be democratic. We should be able to discuss it as a group. Do you think that maybe we're being sentimental? I mean, are these things, given the scope and the breadth of what you're looking at, Ben, I wonder, do you oftentimes wonder whether or not perhaps an aristocratic model is better, where those that are educated and really know how to write code should be providing the code? I mean, Hammurabi thought so, right? I mean, you're making statements that I believe are right and that I agree with them. And I also question them, because if you develop code that people are living under, say, 500 years from now, should we be questioning what the precepts and tenets or the principles are?
It's a very good question. And I think that this is the year in which the most elections globally are going to happen ever. And we may find out that people do find the democracy sentimental if they make certain choices in the coming years. But I think that part of the thing that's also interesting about this question is that, to a certain degree, by being societally platformed by Apple and Facebook and Google, we have actually, to a certain degree, let an aristocracy of shareholders essentially decide, you know, what society will look like. And so we have changed in that way. And we need to, this kind of movement into making the government digital, unless we correct course, then that same impulse to give the government over to private vendors, as we have done so much of the rest of society, might be the final moment of considering democracy as the primary form of government.
It's a great point, because we need to talk about the why and the how of the work that you're doing, but also there is an elevated role that society in general needs to take on, to understand and take on, because to your point, there are different rules, different protocols, and different responsibilities with this new set of public code, right? This new digital era, this new digital infrastructure. So if we think about the work that you and the team are leading, Ben, so much of what you're unpacking is not only kind of methodologies, right, in infrastructure, but also mindsets. It's complex. It is intentionally collaborative, or perhaps hopefully increasingly collaborative. But many societies are very comfortable with the old protocols and how things get done. So maybe walk us through some of the work you're doing, and both the why and the how of your leading the journey and facilitating the shift, both for the institutions that serve, but also the constituents that are served.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the first thing to sort of unpack is what the value of open source is in general. And that's the thing, I think, that the prospect of the type of work that open source allows for is the thing that public administrations don't yet understand and need to understand in order to see the value in what we're doing. And open source is an approach to generating software and generating very large technical products that utilizes the collaborative efforts of hundreds of thousands of collaborators in very large projects, which include things like Linux, which is the world's largest, most installed operating system, and Apache, which powers most of the internet, WordPress, which basically was the first wave of social technology. All of these things are very complicated, very large undertakings that most people, I think, assume can only be undertake by things the scale of the corporation. That sort of, especially in the American model, what we've been taught is that if you're going to build something the scale of Facebook, it has to be, you know, traded on the stock market, essentially, in order for that to be viable. But the reality of the situation is that some of the largest software projects have hundreds of different software studios working simultaneously to make them modern, to keep them up to date, to fix the bugs, all of that. And that is a huge orchestration process. And these pieces of software need very large organizations that serve as the places in which they can coordinate activities across numbers of actors. And so the issue is that the public sector does not understand yet that they have the power to create these frameworks themselves. They wait to hear from their vendors about, here's the latest thing you should do, and you should implement this, and it's going to cost you $1 million a month, and you're going to put your data on our database, which we happen to own, and therefore you're sort of sacrificing the rights of your citizens in order to get this software from us. And that relationship is one in which the public sector is now starting to understand what they have given away and how they have locked themselves into relationships with proprietary software vendors. And they don't really know how to get out of that. And so in Europe, recently, some of the public administrations have understood that if they build things themselves in open source, that those things will be unencumbered by these types of things, by these types of onerous fees and extractive data policies and things like that. And so they have undertaken that. But then the thing that they didn't understand at that point was that something like open source needs a sustainable financial model. It needs a way to, if you build something just on your own as a city or a state or as an individual, it's always going to cost you way more than buying it from someone else who has amortize the cost of it across all the other people they're selling it to. And so open source needs to have a collaboration. It needs to be a set of actors working together towards a goal. So you amortize the cost across that community and allow for each individual actor to benefit. And so that is really what open source works as, is a way of harnessing sort of collective productive power to collaboratively build something. And so that awareness is something that the public sector doesn't understand its own power to participate in, although a lot of frameworks, I mean, obviously the idea of the nation state is about coordinating the possible productive capabilities of states and cities. And similarly, the European Union, for instance, is very much platformed for creating this type of collaboration between the national actors. And so by educating them on the kind of vehicles that are available for collaboration, which involve these sort of open source models, it's really a huge mind shift. But as soon as people begin to understand that, they really see where the overlapping kind of patterns between how the collaborative systems of open source work and the collaborative systems of national scale governments and international scale treaty organizations work, because that is what they're there for, is to sort of laterally share this type of benefit. And so if you can sort of make them understand that this is one of the core possibilities in the future for these types of organizations, then they get behind it. And so none of these entities change fast. I mean, in some ways, that's actually partially their job, right? I mean, the Silicon Valley for a long time had this move fast and break things was what they like to talk about doing. And the government is literally the opposite of that. And the government exists in order to ensure that nothing breaks. And so if its job is to do that, then it needs to not move that fast, probably. So it in some ways is the immovable object that the unstoppable force of technology is pushing against. But there is the ability of the civilization is a process of metabolizing these types of changes into social value is the hope, right? And so the idea that we have had many waves of technology, I mean, civilization is a process built on the arrival of technology, agriculture, was the technology that created civilization. And so pretty much, you know, technology has been metabolized by civilization again over time. The running water, electricity, all of these things, the idea of a logistics network, these types of things are things that are so much part of the infrastructure that we live in now that we don't even see them as technology anymore. And that's one of the things that we need to really be sort of conscious of, is that we invent things all the time. And right when we invent them, we call them technology for the first 30 or so years while they're still fresh and changing society really rapidly. But then once we understand their value and how we relate to them as a society, we call them infrastructure if they work. And once they're infrastructure, they become a right. And it's in that moment where they become a right that everything changes. The idea of universal access, the idea of this type of accountability when it doesn't work, these things. And usually in the way, at least that our current sort of economic model works, that's the moment that the for-profit industries start to not be that interested in it anymore, because the value has been extracted and now it's just something that has to be provided to people. And so that's where the public administration comes in to catch that and make it into infrastructure and make it into something that's provided on a societal scale. And so that's kind of the moment that we're in with computation and network technologies right now.
So it's fascinating to listen, Ben. I mean, you're discussing these kind of this hidden metropolis or this sort of these clusters of silent cities. And then also at the same time, talking about differently hidden citizens or people that aren't even aware that they can make a difference or that they can really contribute to something and commute across these digital barriers. You're reminding me of rights, this kind of a permission. We have read, write, executable. I love the fluidity between these rights and permissions. And as you talk about civil, it is also with the cost of that metabolization, you're adding on more and more permissions. I'm wondering, can you please tell us a little bit more about Barcelona and in the specifics of some of the project, could illustrate some of these efforts out and how, in particular, people were able to learn that were able to participate more?
Yeah, well, that when we started the foundation, we began in Amsterdam. We now have a chapter here in North America as well, but we have a European chapter. And the European chapter worked primarily initially with a couple of different municipalities in Europe who had sort of understood the value of working in the open and the prospect of sharing code bases. And one of the first ones to arrive at that realization was Barcelona Municipality. There, at the time, their CTO was Francesca Bria, who has become a real champion of this type of approach. And they were with the Podemos party, which was focused a lot on getting citizen empowerment in decision-making in the municipality. And so one of the things that Barcelona at the time became famous for was that they decided they were going to pedestrianize a number of intersections in the Eixample neighborhood of Barcelona, which is famous for being one of the first urban planned areas in the world. It's like has these huge boulevards that intersect at these right angles that have these kind of cutout corners. So you have these very large intersections there's a grid across that part of the city. And so they said, well, we're going to start pedestrianizing some of these intersections. And when we do that, we're going to basically be creating small urban parks in the intersections. And we would like to poll the citizens or ask the citizens about what they'd like to do in those intersections. And so they started to design this piece of software that they called Decidim, which means we decide in Catalan. And it is a local democracy tool for allowing people to make suggestions for, in the first case, they were making suggestions on how to furnish, use a discretionary budget provided by the city to furnish the intersections and make them into parks. And so people could submit these proposals and vote, make comments on the proposals and vote to change them, and then vote on which proposal they wanted to implement and then watch it implemented. And so this piece of software became more and more flexible over time because they were using it in different contexts. And it was sort of generalized as a way of having discretionary budgeting or other local decision-making processes presented to citizens as kind of a decision-making system. And that they realized, you know, that they really wanted to be able to, first of all, other municipalities understood this problem as well and were hoping that Barcelona would share. And Barcelona also was very interested in sharing their code base. And so they started to build an organization which was separate outside of the municipality where it had been developed, to become the stewardship organization for the code base, for the software itself. And so they moved that. We the Foundation for Public Code, also helped in the process of them building this and making the code into a shareable system. And so part of what we did in that process was come up with something we call the standard for public code, which is a set of criteria by which people that have developed a code base that is an open source that would like to share with other public administrations. If a city or state has developed something that they think, oh, this would be great to have a community of practice around so that we can do this cost sharing that I was speaking of earlier, then there's this set of criteria that they can look at to evaluate, is it well documented? Is the code base containerized? Is it ready to be unboxed, essentially? How low can you make the barrier of entry for other municipalities and states to implement and contribute back to a software project like this? And that's kind of, in general, how we're working with cities. Barcelona was one of the first cities that we worked with in this way, and we're now they've taken this code base to hundreds of other municipalities now, DCDEM has, and to states. It's been used in the Finnish national government and in various places in the US now as well, in North America and around the world.
So a question. When it was unboxed and reviewed, and was it properly containerized? Was the code properly documented? This is a big issue in development circles, different practices. How did that process go?
Well, I mean, these are lots of different learnings in a lot of cases, the people that are working on these projects. Barcelona has a very strong community of civil society, open computing kind of enthusiasts. And so that they, in some ways, this was a groundswell there. Their relationship with the city was already in effect. And so those people were bringing the practices for this project and using it as an example to drive that. But a lot of times what we're trying to do now is help municipalities understand they have upcoming contract renewals with private providers, or they're just about to go into procurement for a certain type of tool that they're looking to build or to buy. And we say, why don't you consider instead forming a collaborative project with other municipalities and states that have this need? And each of you can hire your own development studio that has local capacity, and those people can go into an orchestrated development process. And that's actually quite a bit more complicated at the outset. But if you can start that process from the beginning, then it's in the DNA of the project. If you build something to be shared from the outset, it's much easier than if you try and open something up later on because people are concerned that the code base is too messy or that these types of things at a later time. So the idea that we're hoping to inspire is that this is a possible approach going forward. And to that end, there's also a movement within public administrations, not just in government, but also in academy and even within the private sector, to have an office within the administration that's called the Open Source Program Office, or OSPO. And a lot of academic institutions, but also government entities now have these offices. And those people, interestingly, are the ones that when another part of the organization says they're going to go to tender around a piece of software, they can compile a document that says these things exist in the open ecosystem, and these are possible solutions. Some of them don't exactly fit the use case, but the good thing about them being open is that you can start with the thing that doesn't exactly fit and hire an entity to move it into the use case that you need. And so this mindset of participating in the open ecosystem at the outset is the thing that's our real sort of long-term target for the public relationship with open source ecosystem.
Yeah. Ben Knight, I've been reflecting as I listen to you on the sheer magnitude of this effort and the journey. To your point, as you were articulating earlier, the way we've always done things has really resulted in a lot of lockups, right? For data, for ownership, for those embedded vendor relationships and processes, and frankly, the black box code, sets of code that underpin a lot of the operations. And as your team and your community are leading this shift, you're not only changing, you're working on changing the vision for what is possible and what great looks like, but in changing those mindsets, you're also changing the methodologies and the protocols. So if we maybe take Barcelona or some of your other work as an example, how long of a journey is that normally? Because you're unraveling kind of the locked up commitments and the big prime commitments, and beginning to open things up and establish.
I think that I think that there are multiple different kind of timelines in effect. There are certainly states, there are actors like Barcelona that are sort of leaning forward themselves. I mean, as much as, like I said, a relatively slow moving public organization, just in terms of risk aversion, that's always something they have to consider, so that they're moving as fast as they can. But there are also globally, there are states and cities that really are in the forefront of this type of activity. I mean, Estonia is known internationally as an e-state, they call themselves, because every activity with the public administration can be accomplished through a digital interface. And now, interestingly, and so we work with them quite a bit when we're sort of helping them to articulate the case in a way that plugs into the policy frameworks of all the other places that they'd like to share with. And they're a really great collaborator for us because they are a very small state. They have, just logistically, it's a lot easier to provide services for a constituency of the size of Estonia than it is for something like the United States. But it's also that their kind of self-identity is about being a digital first country, that their sovereignty emerged in a post-digital period, right? So they were able to implement their first sort of independent infrastructures in a relatively modern digital age. But probably interestingly, the most digitally forward country at the moment, and the one that probably would have leapfrogged Estonia as the sort of primary reference as a digital state, unfortunately, as history had other plans for them, this would be the Ukraine, who launched their own e-state application about 2 months before the war began. And it's an incredibly modern toolkit that they've created, and they are now also replicating this toolkit. In fact, Estonia is going to be replicating their code base and using that in their own stack for e-state applications. And so the point with that is that those actors can lead by example, right? I mean, a lot of times learning about how to implement and relate to a technology comes through watching other peer entities go through that process. And so having administrations like the Ukraine and like Estonia be moving so fast into these domains and seeing the real wins that their citizens and residents are having because of that has really served as an accelerant to the discussions one has with larger states. So Germany, France, the Netherlands, Sweden, Canada, the United States, Colombia, interestingly, is very pro-digital transformation at the moment. But there are a lot of, and Taiwan, of course, Taiwan, Audrey Tang, who's the Minister for Digital Transformation in Taiwan, is on our strategic council and also one of the most preeminent actors in this space. And they really have done an enormous amount of work to bring the Taiwanese digital transformation to the forefront of citizen services.
I'm listening to you also just wondering if this gives us maybe some great kind of frameworks in order to revisit some of the other systems of ownership. So systems of ownership around data, systems of ownership around even intellectual property, right? Is there a better way, a way to leverage advanced technologies in some of these systems in order to kind of decalcify how we're thinking about ownership of IP, of data, and contribute maybe a more precise, more thoughtful way to leverage and unlock some of the value in those massive stores of value in order to serve greater public good? Have you guys touched upon these systems at all?
Well, I mean, fundamental to the idea of open source is, I mean, it is a question of licensing. It's a question of IP, right? I mean, that's what open source is, the establishment of these licenses that are open. And some of them we don't have a sort of default license that we recommend in all cases, because there are different situations in which different licenses make sense. But the characteristic of all of them is that they can be forked, copied, replicated, but there are some limits. Some of these licenses limit commercial activity and things like that, which, you know, definitely has different constraints for different actors involved. So it depends on what type of thing you're building. But I would say one of the things I found really interesting in the 90s and 2000s, and this is one of the things that I, in some ways, have taking a step back a little bit from the conversations about data. I mean, I still, of course, very much believe in sort of a full accountable understanding of what data ownership is coming out of these situations. But I feel like for a long time, the openness of the data was sort of a red herring from the proprietary software owners to say like, oh, yeah, the data is totally open. We own the system that creates the data. So the problem about that is that you don't actually know how the data was created unless the software is open. But they can say, sure, the data is open. Here's a series of numbers. And you're like, okay, great. Thanks for these numbers. But why? What are they? And oh, sorry, you can't actually know that part. That's the proprietary part. So to me, I feel like the conversation about open data was for a long time, like in the 90s, we started talking about open data and all the way through the 2000s. And that is really where I think that's kind of what got us into this pickle about the closeness of the applications. And I think that if you have open applications, there is no question that the data will be open because, I mean, you can design a system that run an instance of the application that has a closed data output, but like fundamentally, you're going to know how the data is generated if you use the default open tools for data.
In terms of these questions around provenance and permissibility, the value of that data, who owns it, where it comes from, these are things that we see evolving. It's interesting that we met and that you've spent so much time, I guess like me too, in Amsterdam. And I remember it was, I don't know, maybe like 2000, 2001, I heard about open source. And I remember it just blew my mind. I was like, oh, of course, right? And now it seems as though I'm almost at times having a difficult, difficulty explaining the idea that there are profitable models within open source and that people have huge libraries. I mean, Epic Games is just one of thousands that we can list where people interact with on a daily basis. In Amsterdam, there's something, I want to get back a little bit just to touch on this idea of governance models. Amsterdam is a city that, like many American cities, San Francisco, New York, Denver, is an open port with new technologies moving through it. I think that because they were traders, they became very quick to adapt other ways of thinking, collaboration and ways of contribution that has always been keeping Amsterdam forward in many ways, much more than I think the size of the city would merit. So you're living in Amsterdam, you're teleporting around the world, you have these views coming together, Ben, as though you view history kind of like this river. Can you tell us a little bit about what you see happening next? What is the convergence of these things? And I would love it if you could try to maybe give us a use case or an example of what you would imagine things to look like, perhaps in Amsterdam, an American city, in say, look, I don't know, let's go 20, 50 years, if you can.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think bringing up Amsterdam is a super important point. I think definitely for the sort of trade aspect and the connection with the world, obviously they're a huge trading power, and that was based on the fact that they were so collaborative with the people in all of the nations that they were working with. But I would say the other thing that makes them the reason why the foundation is homed there is that there is literally no way you can fail to understand the value of infrastructure if you live underwater, it turns out. so that is the main reality of the Netherlands, is it is a place of the depth, I should say, of understanding of the value of infrastructure is incredible. One of the largest exports. I mean, the Netherlands exports architecture, urban planning, infrastructural development, the making of land, these types of the agricultural technologies, things that are like core infrastructure. And that is, in general, I think when you talk about things like private models that exist on open infrastructure, that is literally what the transport system, these types of things. I mean, obviously Amazon is the company it is because of the American road network, which they did not build. And this is these types of things, these relationships, that part of what the Netherlands understands is that things like regulation, things like infrastructural provision, those are frameworks on which venture is built. Those are frameworks on which, like, again, if people talk about venture capital, if you're sending ships out into the ocean day after day filled with crews of people that might not come back, that's like the OG venture. But the entire culture of the Netherlands was built around the sort of provisioning that with infrastructure in that, and that's was sort of in some ways cultural machine for the production of the capability of that type of venture. And so in some ways, infrastructure isn't just for individual citizens, it's for industry as well. And so the idea that all of this open, all of these open things kind of bank the capabilities of those systems as a baseline to start from for all of the ventures involved. So to turn briefly toward the future, I would say probably the number one thing that we are about to go into, which is also an amazing sort of connection, I think, that we share, is that we've been talking about what now Apple is finally getting everyone to call spatial computing for decades and decades. In the 90s, we worked in VR 1.0, but now we are about to head into a situation where we really, the idea of capture, platform capture, is not a metaphor. The idea of spatial computing is that computation lives in the environment, and this is really the final frontier of public code. If a municipality or a state does not have its own model for what its spatial representation is, then that model is owned by a private entity and public space is privatized. And that is what we're facing right now. And a place like the Netherlands is really interesting because the Netherlands ostensibly has been virtual reality since before computation. The Netherlands, they have one of the highest resolution spatial models of their land because they made part of it. So they're ready for, I mean, they have done spatial computing on their terrain for hundreds of years. And now that's going to be aided by technology to make a model that is their understanding of space. In fact, there is a thing called the omgevingsbeleid, a nice handy Dutch word, which means the spatial data law. And basically that means if you are a public agency that is producing spatial data, you have to open it and make it indexable such that any application can find the spatial data and return that result to a search. And so the idea that they are ready for the onset of spatial computing and the idea that the city will be a stack that is filled with physical infrastructure and digital spatial infrastructure in the future is something that societies are preparing for or should be. And I think that the Netherlands is starting to think about that. So the idea that you have the routing of your journey across town or your finding of a friend who is elsewhere in the city that has shared their location with you, all of these activities should be publicly supported activities, public infrastructure supported activities. But I think in general, the idea that digital storage and computational capabilities are the right of every resident of a place, the idea that a public backplane like AWS, Amazon services, might exist on a national level in every country and allow you to spin up, let's say you want to build a high-density residential building with 30 other families, there shouldn't be a reason why there's not an application you can spin up that allows you to form a financial vehicle together that gets financing and has a relationship with the zoning people and the real estate people and the architects that are all enabled by a digital process that has roles that everyone fits in. In general, I would say the biggest task that software has undertaken in the last 30 years is providing an organizational framework to things like corporations, things like SAP and all of these application Oracle, things that provide the core of what companies are able to do productively together. There's no reason why software can't provide that framework of productive collaboration to other arbitrary groups of people working in different ways. And so I think that responsibility to provide those frameworks lies with the public sector and the ability for people to spin up things like a cooperative or, you know, a thing that allows them to work together towards some kind of creative activity.
Yeah, there's a lot to be done in terms of sovereign conversational systems and sovereign intelligence is able to model these sorts of things. I'm interested to see, too, whether and in which countries, because we'll surely have both, whether we see areas where people are really collaborating very tightly and basically iterating on the new kind of a communism and deciding, oh, collaboration is going to be the key direction to go, and I think also extreme other versions of it. But the public space not having a spatial computing model, forcing it to then be privatized or commoditized, is frightening, Ben. I'm like, That's so right. Why haven't I been noticing this? Thank you.
Yeah, it's real. It's very real. I think that the idea of part of where we're at is figuring out what the middle road is between there are modes of collective activity. And this is partially what's so interesting about being in Europe and being based in Amsterdam, is that Amsterdam is very specifically, the culture sits between, it is a social welfare state in which many services are taken for granted that America does not provide its citizens at all. And that is a form of collaborative activity that brings us towards further collaboration. However, also, it is a very mercantile place that it believes in the success of the market and its actors. I mean, partially one of the things that's so interesting about the Netherlands right now is that it has, in many cases, the Dutch are kind of secretly doing all sorts of things that people don't realize puts them in the driver's seat. But this company, ASML, is probably the most technologically valuable company in the West at the moment. It is a nanolithography company that makes chips like the M1 possible, and it is Dutch-based. And these are the sorts of things that are not, again, they have taken advantage of the technological infrastructure available to them in the Netherlands in order to build one of the world's most advanced and valuable companies in a context that is not a totally liberalized market, but instead part of one of these situations that has these kind of collaborative infrastructures. And so the question is, can we, in doing this kind of exporting of technical models, can part of the reason why we're based in the Netherlands is that if you're using a certain sort of prototype of a certain mechanism that's in the public, that is in one rule space, the policy rule space, if you're going to say, we're going to encode this in software and allow it to be shared, why don't we find the mechanisms that are best functioning? And so the Netherlands has a lot of these mechanisms in the way that it creates collaborative infrastructures for its citizens and for its enterprises. And if we can bring that to a larger set of policy contexts and technical contexts, then I think we've done good work.
Yeah, it's amazing, Ben. I think that at the bottom of all of this complexity, the provenance, the permissibility, the code of law, the code of language, all of this seems to me to boil down to fairness and respect for each other.
Trust.
Trust, fairness, and respect. We're all actually into Hammurabi's code also. And even though there's some very strange, it's like, whatever, 3,000 years old or something, I guess, right? It's 1,000 years old. But a lot of those principles of fairness, trust, respect seem really at the foundation. And I'm very glad, Ben, that you are working at the deep foundation levels. I have immense admiration for your work, and I'm looking forward to seeing where we go next. Thank you.
Cheers. Thank you all.
I would double click on Mark's comments. I just can't wait to see where this goes, and I think we all are anticipating the economic and the social unpack or unlock that banking these capabilities really could represent and should represent for it. This just allows us to kind of encode, if you will, the next level of infrastructure upon which new entrepreneurship, new innovation, and new societal benefits should reside. So thank you for the work that you and the team are leading, and we look forward to what's next.
Thanks so much.
Thanks again, everyone, for joining us today, and please do check out this season's new episodes to join our discovery journey as we explore the AI arena, pressure testing hype versus reality, and understanding where practical applications of these capabilities are shaping ecosystemic futures. Follow us and subscribe on Apple Podcasts for your favorite place to access podcasts, and you can always learn more at shoshimworks.com.